Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's high noon, a beautiful Saturday afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in to Nation Radio. We have Oilers stories of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and major hockey news around the world. Nation Radio brought to you by Edmonton Motors. Your questions are always welcome. Please email them to nationradio at theteam1260.com. We're also on Twitter at It's Nation Radio, and I check out my own personal Twitter, lowtide_. Our producer, Connor Halley, has a rocking Twitter place. So are you up to 145 now? Or
I got a new follower today. I think it's because you tweeted me.
There you go. See, it's happening.
The power of low tide.
Whenever I get a new follower, I always check because it's usually one of those sites that you click to and it's not, you can't really go there. It's a bad one. But you're trending there,
buddy. Kind of like your website.
Yeah, there
some
you
bad
go.
Bad links there.
Good point. I also grab questions from the comment section at Low Tide and Oilers Nation as well, so you can drop them off there. Our guests today include Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun. We'll talk about the Oilers' summer, what Terry will be covering if there is no NHL this year, and we'll probably discuss the Eskimos, and that should take 4 or 5 minutes out of the show there. Jonathan Willis from Cult of Hockey and Oilers Nation. Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy and Pass It to Bulis. Cam Charon from Leafs Nation. Also Thomas Drance from Canucks Army. He will be in today. And Eric Tulski from Broad Street Hockey and NHL Numbers. By popular request, lots of people want to ask that guy some questions. So we have him for a 15-minute segment today. So make sure to email or tweet your questions to Eric and our other guests today. Oiler news is tough to find this week. I'll be honest with you. Sam Gagne worked with Sid Crosby's trainer and is stronger and faster than ever. He can do everything but leap a building in a single bound. Seriously, he apparently is a lot faster. Jim Matheson had the story in the Edmonton Journal. I'm a big Gagne fan. I think he's a really good young hockey player. Obviously, speed is a little bit of an issue, and he's not a big guy, although I think he's about Doug Weight size, right? So it's not like he's small in the traditional Ron Chipperfield kind of small. But if he can add another, you know, foot to his speed, and then he can really, I mean, the guy is a sublime passer. He really is. Remember the 8-point night? His first, I think that was the night that his first point was on a bullet pass over about 5,000 yards to Taylor Hall, who got a little bit of a break on the defenseman against Chicago and scored. But the pass was the thing. It was a brilliant pass. And Gagne, if he is faster, I think the Oilers might end up regretting signing him for only that 1 year because he could take it to the bank next year during negotiations. Hopefully we'll be able to watch him in the NHL and the other Oilers as well. Oil Kings preseason underway. They played in Prince George last night. We'll play again this coming Friday night in Red Deer. Oiler picks Mitchell Moraz and Travis Iwanek have already posted crooked numbers in the points column, and it's amazing to see just how many kids are returning for this team. You hate to get in front of the story and say, oh they're going to win again, but I would have to think they're going to be a strong contender to win the Western Hockey League and go to the Memorial Cup again in 2012-13. We'll have Corey Graham, I believe, on next weekend's show, and the following weekend, Kent Simpson, I think that's right. We'll also try to grab Cam Moon here in the next couple of weeks, too, as we get ready for the Western Hockey League season. Oklahoma City Barons season opens in October. Their training camp usually riffs off the NHL camp and would be gearing up in a couple of weeks under normal circumstances. We can expect a big year in Oklahoma City. Of course, we'll be talking to Coach Nelson, to Jim Byers, and to others there in Oklahoma, because that could be the big story for Edmonton Oilers fans. I wonder if we'll get some television coverage. You'd think, right? You know, with no NHL, the Western Hockey League is you know, really benefiting Team 1260. It's kind of a radio league. So I would think the American Hockey League, they do stream online, and maybe a Sportsnet or somebody will pick up some games and broadcast them. CBC used to do an AHL, I think Sunday afternoon, game of the week. Maybe that'll continue as well. The big story, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, I'll be honest, but people have asked for updates, so I'm going to give you my thumbnail sketch, and then we're going to ask our guests a little bit today as well. The NHL and Players Association have spoken to each other, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of progress. Pierre LeBrun reported this morning that the two sides spoke briefly today, but will not meet, may touch base tomorrow. That's basically a direct quote from LeBrun. Issues include what is and isn't hockey-related revenue, which side has a better mousetrap, where to order the lunch, how to split the pie, and on it goes. This comes down to, I believe, the NHL owners having all the cards. It's like playing Monopoly, but the only places you own are Ventnor Avenue and the B&O Railroad. It's only a matter of time. That's my suspicion for anybody involved in the NHLPA. And maybe I keep expecting, because he's such a smart guy and has such a history of winning, he and Marvin Miller, I expect Donald Fehr to pull some magic out of his hat. But so far, we haven't seen that. And the negotiations are going, I think, as we would expect. It's difficult, I'm sure, for the players because they're giving up a year of peak performance and peak pay at their level. The owners, I mean, if you're Ed Snyder, you've owned the team for 44 years, you miss a year, big whoop, right? But if you're an NHL hockey player and not a superstar, but say a marginal guy, a guy who's got 4 or 5 years in and might have a couple of more years, this season represents something major in terms of cost. And if you've been around, I talked to Jason Strudwick about this last weekend, and you know, this is a guy who played, you know, 13 years or something like that in the National Hockey League. And if you add up all the paychecks, because you know the entry-level deal was as low could be, and then if you add them all up, his big paydays were later on. He missed a year. He had signed a big contract, as you recall. He said that last week. He signed a big deal, and he had to wait a year for it because that's the way the lockout occurred. But it also impacted him. Corey Cross played here the year the Oilers went to the finals. The new rules impacted, but it also cost him a year of salary. So these guys, I remember Bill Guerin about a year ago talking about the NBA lockout, and he recommended, he said, it wasn't worth it. And the reason for that was that it cost him a year. He ended up getting bought out and, you know, continued his career elsewhere, but it was a difficult time for him. And it's hard to know where this is going to go, and certainly the National Hockey League is planning on locking out the players on September 15th, and we'll go from there. But from my point of view, I just don't see where the NHL Players Association has a lot of leverage and is going to be able to find a lot of footing to make this negotiation go. It's a sticky wicket, as they say. Now, at 7 minutes after 12, joined now by Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun. How are you, sir?
I'm not badly.
So let's start with how many holidays you get in a year?
Depends.
Because you were on, from what I could tell from your Twitter feed, you took about a month and a half there, bud.
Yes, I did, and it's been a long time since I've done that. Covered a bit of ground, too. Took my grandson, 12 years old, and we went all over the American West.
That must have been a great, great, just a fabulous trip.
Yeah, it was. In the middle of it, we went as far east as Mount Rushmore and far south down into New Mexico and across Arizona and all the way to Disneyland. And I flew my wife and his mom and his almost 4-year-old brother into Disneyland for about 7 or 8 days, and then put them back on a plane and went up to San Francisco and Alcatraz and all the way up to the Oregon coast, which I just adore, and then finally kicked it home and seized up my engine just south of it.
You're the best grandpa ever.
Oh, they're hard days.
Okay, let's talk about your view of the CBA negotiations. How do you see this breaking down, Terry?
I've said it from the beginning, and I still haven't seen any evidence at all that that it won't go past the Grey Cup. This isn't one where you're in the first two here. You know, people had great arguments and spent a lot of time picking sides, and this one is just, they're both wrong. They're not really. It's basically just to see who wins and who can get the best deal. There's no, there's no small market thing attached to Edmonton like there was in the previous ones or any of that stuff on the table. And basically the players have to show that and if you're around the players at all, you know, after what happened the last time around, that they have no taste for losing an entire season again. You just know that. The owners know it. Everybody knows it, right? So they have to be able to stay out for a couple of months to prove that they've got the will. And and the owners, on the other hand, you've got so many American teams who don't really get their crowds until after, you know, you get into December and the National Football League season's kind of evaporating, and so it just looks to me like, for no good reason, the NHL is going to go at least to the Grey Cup.
So this is just a giant, like, basically an ego contest, and there are some remnants, like the fact that crowds are not expected in the southern part of the state, so that also helps out a little bit. This is, you don't see this going into January.
Oh, absolutely possible. I mean, by that point, if you get past the Grey Cup, you know, now you get people dug in, and now they're mad at each other, and you get all sorts of emotions and everything involved. But right now, it's... you know, unless I'm missing something, it's a battle over 7% of, you know, who gets 57% and who gets 43%. And, you know, I mean, it seems logically that they'd end up around somewhere around 50% when they get there to play hockey.
Let's talk a little. We're with Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun. Let's talk a little bit about the Edmonton Oilers. They signed Justin Schultz, drafted Nail Yakupov, brought back Ryan Smith. Should Oilers fans be optimistic about maybe a playoff push, or is this still a team in the deep in the second division?
Well, it starts as a team deep in the second division, but there's so much optimism and legitimate optimism. And remember, they got a new coach in Ralph Krueger. And I'm in the process of preparing a two-part series on Ralph getting ready to actually step into the job here as we speak. But they're in a situation where essentially they're beginning the journey with this year. As soon as they finally start playing hockey, the real journey begins. The last 3 years have been mostly about collecting assets and totally refitting the organization and getting everything in place to go forward. Well, it's now time to go forward. And I think it's more important in the early stages of this season to show a lot of people within the organization that this is going to happen and to develop all the right attitudes and everything in the dressing room going forward, so you don't see too many situations where, you know, they're throwing up their hands and saying, well, we can't win this one. You want to see that spirit there, and Ralph talks about that. But if you're asking me where I think they're going to finish this year without making any stupid statements about eating my column or something like that, I think they've got a legitimate chance of finishing in the playoffs. I understand the hockey news has come out and said they'll be 13th or something, and let's face it, they were right the last 2 years or pretty close to being right. I think they're missing something on this time around, especially with some of the streamlining the Oilers can do in terms of some of the players that shouldn't have been on the ice that now no longer are likely to be on the ice. And I think that's a big thing that people are missing here.
That's a good point.
And I also think that with Devan Dubnyk, I went overseas to the World Hockey Championships, and I saw Devan Dubnyk over there that he only played an exhibition game and two tournament games, but there was just a different guy than had gone the previous 2 years. He looked so confident and so... so at home in that company that I'm expecting he's going to pick up right where he left off in the second half of the year. So I think they'll be much better back there as well. But overall, on the whole thing, and we'll get into this more, I guess, as the lockout goes on, if it does. And I think it's to the advantage of this team to play perhaps a 60-game schedule. I mean, you've got a lot of young kids, some of them who haven't played, you know, 82 game schedules more than a year or two. And you got a coach from Europe, essentially, who is used to coaching those number of games. I think it could work in their favor.
You know, the last time the Oilers finished ahead of the Calgary Flames in the standings was 02-03. Hemsky was a rookie. Marchand was the top scoring center. I wonder if this... I picked the Oilers to finish 9th to 11th, but I believe this is the year they pass the Flames. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree, and I just don't see in the Calgary concept, and I don't think anybody in Calgary seems to see this other than one or two individuals there on the management and coaching side. I just don't see the Flames with an upward arrow there. They've moved past the you know, the window of being able to get the ultimate for, or the maximum rather, for Jerome Iginla. So they're going to be dealing with a player that whose arrow is, you know, he's still an excellent player. To have more time for Jerome Iginla as a person and a player and a leader and all those things than most players in the National Hockey League, but that doesn't change the fact that his arrow is going to be down for the, you know, for the rest of his career. Hopefully not straight down, but you know, in an angle down. Mika Kiprusoff, the other asset there, you know, I mean, can you imagine where the Flames would have finished last year without Kiprusoff? You know, he's still, you know, you could still get the maximum for him, but I think most people in Calgary, I certainly do, I think most people in Calgary think that, you know, all of a sudden the example is up north and it's time for them to blow her up.
What would you cover, you know, you mentioned the Kruger article, I'll look forward to that. What will you cover if the NHL does go dark? Will you spend time with the Barons, the Oil Kings, that sort of thing? Or?
Well, I was, until last night's football game, kind of expecting to write a fair amount of football going there. But you got to wonder.
Yeah, really.
I think the beauty of the situation here this year in terms of hockey is, and the... is the fact the Oil Kings went to the Memorial Cup last year and are projected by just about everybody to have an excellent chance of not just getting back to the Memorial Cup, but winning it this time. That should be a whale of a hockey club. And I'm looking forward to, you know, to following them at the front end of the season this time as opposed to, you know, following them like I did last year, which was almost full-time late in the season in the first round of the playoffs and of course in the Memorial Cup when I got back from the World Championships.
You mentioned the Eskimos, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but they look like a contender on defense and a pretender on offense, and I wonder if it's too late, right? There's nobody you can bring in to fix this. Is it a matter of tightening up or bringing in the third string quarterback, or is this it?
This is it. I mean, I think there's some point here where, and I mean, the best play they had last night was a botched snap last play of the first half pass by the third string quarterback you refer to, and I'm ready to see him play. You know, Kerry Joseph would be a wonderful story if he pulled something off here, and there's still that chance of that. There was no stage last night where, as my son Shane, who works for Canadian Press, put it, you know, that there was any feeling there that this would be a good place to put in Giles. I see no remaining future for him. I think, you know, he's shown what he can, or more accurately, can't do. And so it's either Joseph or bust. But right now, their biggest problem... the defense has to win games, period, right?
No.
But the defense hasn't played lately like it played in the front end of the season, mostly because of two, you know, really key missing parts on the defensive line. So there is hope there. But with Calgary winning those two games, BC being the team it is, and, you know, Calgary has two games against Winnipeg, and you look at it, we're looking at a team here, I think, as of right this minute, that's playing for third place against Saskatchewan instead of one that, going into the game last night, was playing for first and second place with BC and Calgary.
Terry, thanks for this, man.
All right. Have fun with the show.
Thanks, bud. That's Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun. Great guy. Great columnist. You know what? He's told it like it is all down the line. You go from 1979. You can Google Terry Jones, Edmonton Journal at that time, Sun later on. And, you know, he really did. I mean, he all down the line, if you read his stuff, he's in there representing the fan and talking about the way things are. And he did that just now with the Oilers and their chances. He's pretty bullish, which I'm pleased by because he's a smart guy. And on the Eskimos, which was a little deflating, let's be honest, but the season's not over yet. And, you know, go away. Eskimos, especially because I'm married to a Ryder fan. Man, do I want the Eskimos to do well. It's 1220. Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy and Pasa Tabulas on the way next. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1226. This is Nation Radio. We're around until 2 o'clock today. We have Harrison Mooney just around the corner. Eric Tulski. Interesting guy. I mean, an advanced stats guy who's breaking new ground, and he can explain it. I like him. Cam Charon from Leafs Nation, and we also have Thomas Trance from Canucks Army, and Jonathan Willis, our good friend, will be around the corner as well. Not a lot of Oilers-specific news. I mentioned Sam Gagne at the top of the show. There's an article up, I think it was Joanne Ireland, talking about Theo Pekham and the fact that he's in really good shape. And tough for Theo Pekham because this is the point in his career where nobody's really passed him. He and Jeff Petrie were drafted the same year, and Pekham arrived earlier because he'd played junior and Petrie had played in college, so we didn't get to see him very often. But at this point now, the players drafted after Theo Pekham, which would include anybody 07 on, which would be Alex Plante and all the other guys. But Oscar Klefbom's like a year away. And he looks like he's close to NHL ready. You've got guys like Musil, Marinchin, they're all coming, and they are really coming because Marinchin starts playing pro hockey now. Then you got guys like Brandon Davidson who could end up playing here, and on it goes. So an important year for Pekham, and I thought Joanne Ireland did a really good job in that interview. You might want to check it out at the Edmonton Journal. Joined now by Mr. Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy and Pasa Tabulas. How are you this afternoon?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm good. Now, I have a question that's not hockey-related, and then we'll get to hockey, okay?
Bring it.
During the Vancouver Olympics, my wife and I watched the entire thing, and she was outraged that 90% of the British tabloid talk and the news information that went to Britain was about the rain in Vancouver, the badly organized Olympics. So we watched very closely your London series with interest, and it certainly had an impact in my house. We were laughing and doing high fives. What kind of reaction did you get on your London Olympics piece?
It was a pretty bad reaction. They did not like it. I was doing a column called the Worst Olympics Ever for The Guardian, and The Guardian asked me to do it. That was what they wanted. And so I kind of turned it around. I did the very negative slant on the coverage, and I picked apart everything I could, and tried to make it very satirical. And the British people did not appreciate it. I got tons of hate mail, emails, people telling me that I was ruining journalism, that I was the worst person alive. A couple of half-hearted death threats. I don't think anybody seemed that serious about it. They just kind of wanted me to die. They weren't actually willing to do it. A lot of really, really nasty feedback. It was a lot of fun.
Well, maybe they were just upset the colonies had a voice.
Possible.
Well, anyway, at least in part of Canada, there were lots of high fives and we enjoyed it. So
thank you.
Maybe next time you can do something on it. Well, maybe you don't want to.
I'm never going to London. I'll tell you that.
Let's talk lockout. This looks like a case of stubborn versus bullheaded. Is that really the way to frame the issue?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. I mean, you've got the NHLPA saying that they're not going to relinquish that 57% cut of hockey-related revenue, and you've got the NHL saying that they're not willing to go ahead if the NHLPA is still holding on to that percentage. And at this point, neither side is budging. They met last week, and there was hopefully the NHL was thinking the NHLPA would come down or make some concessions, and they just didn't. I mean, effectively, that second NHLPA counter proposal was just a cocktail napkin that said nope. So I think that we are in for the long haul here because both sides refuse to budge.
And it doesn't seem as though Terry Jones said it in the previous conversation we had. It doesn't. There's no small market versus big market per se because the sliding scale of the salary cap, and it's sliding up for the poor teams. There doesn't seem to be the big major issues that do pull people apart. This is a conversation that could be had. We want to go from 57 to somewhere. Is 50-50 going to work? You could probably do this in about 10 minutes if you had the heart to do it, right?
Yeah, I mean, you'd think so. It's a really simple issue at the heart of it. It's not that complicated. It's just a percentage at this point. But you know, you have to have one side willing to give, and the problem is neither side will. And on top of that, you know, Gary Bettman has a pretty excellent record when it comes to negotiations. The man tends to get what he wants. And Donald Fair, he's come in here, you know, really trumped up as a guy who also tends to get what he wants. And I think you've got, you know, two guys here who have a lot of pride at play, and neither one of them wants to walk away from this the loser. And somebody's going to have to give at some point, and I couldn't even begin to tell you who I think it'll be.
So it's impossible that two major egos could derail an entire season, though. At some point in time, somebody, even if it's an unlikely source, like maybe the Philadelphia Flyers owner, will come to his senses and realize that losing in another entire season is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, when it comes down to it, the thing that always tends to trump ego is money, and there's just too much money to be made playing this season for the entire season to be gone. Eventually, you know, if it's not the Philadelphia Flyers owner, it'll just be, you know, the prospect of money lost. I mean, you know, you're fighting over a percentage of revenues, but if there's none coming in, what's the point? So at some point, it is going to have to bend. I don't think we're going to lose the entire season just because that would be just atrocious, just a catastrophic situation for everybody involved. But it is going to be a while, I think.
In conversation with Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy and Pasatibulis, and because of the major story that's happening, which is the NHLPA CBA negotiations, some unusual things are happening on the left coast, as always happens. For instance, has Roberto Luongo traded himself to Florida yet, or is that still happening soon?
Well, you know, by all reports, there's no trade coming just because Florida's package isn't very good. I think, I don't even remember the term, Jason Botchford, I think he said it blows. So that's what we're looking at right now. Florida, you know, they're offering guys that would just kind of give them a little bit more cap flexibility, and the Canucks want a prospect at the very least. So as much as Roberto Luongo wants to go there, you know, that's where he spends his offseason with his family. That's his preference is just to stay there. It's not going to happen unless Florida increases their trade or the Canucks decide they're willing to give him away for nothing.
One of the reasons that, like, from I'm not a Canucks fan, but I can understand why the Canucks might want to offload that contract would be if they could acquire Shane Doan, who I think most agree might be an attractive veteran player with some grit and skill to help maybe the Vancouver Canucks get over the hump if you think they need that. And certainly I think they're a good enough team to win it all anyway, but adding Doan can't hurt. But it looks like, based on, and I'm not sure where it came from, but it seems like everybody's adopted it as the truth, Doan is going to return to Phoenix. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. He said on a Phoenix radio station the other day that he has a deal in place with the Coyotes. One of the other radio personalities in Phoenix has actually given the terms of the deal, and it's 4 years at about $21.5 million.
Wow.
But this deal is not official, and it won't be made official until the Phoenix Coyotes ownership situation is settled. And Doan said, I will sign somewhere by September 15th. So if that ownership situation isn't settled by the 15th, then Doan will be signing somewhere else anyway. At this point, that contract is just there, provided everything gets set up, but he's not off the market yet.
Is there a more ideal situation than Vancouver, just based on if he wants to win a Stanley Cup and has to play elsewhere?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, he's got family out here. I know his wife is from the Kelowna area. He likes Vancouver. I mean, it's a situation where, you know, he wouldn't be expected to be the savior. I mean, he'd be playing on a second-line situation probably with Ryan Kessler. You know, really just kind of providing that grit. That's really that missing piece on the Canucks roster. So I think that if he wants to win a Stanley Cup, the Canucks probably are his best option just in terms of the fit for him and what he can do. But at the same time, I don't think that winning a Stanley Cup is his top priority. I think that staying in Phoenix really is. Otherwise, he would have just signed with the Canucks earlier. So at this point, I think that September 15th deadline is really what's going to make his decision for him. But I think that the Canucks are probably his number one option if that deadline passes.
A player that intrigues me, and he did when Buffalo drafted him, and certainly when he went over to Vancouver, played in a support role, but is Zach Cassian, because not the player he is now, but based on his size and what he does, this is a player, if he can play with skill, he might have real value to a good NHL hockey team. Is that the perception that you think Vancouver Canucks have of him? He's not going to be a fourth-line plugger. He might be a little bit more than that.
I think that's the perception the Canucks want Canuck fans to have of him. I don't know that Canuck fans are really on board. They loved Cody Hodgson. They loved him to death. They thought he was, you know, the second coming of Trevor Linden. In the moment that you get pegged the second coming of Trevor Linden, you're just perfect. You're a perfect hockey player. There's nothing wrong with you. You're perfect. So, you know, as soon as he was traded for Zach Kassian, people really soured on that. You know, why did we give up Cody Hodgson? So at this point, Kassian is, you know, he's somebody who has a lot of potential. He really could be that next, maybe even, you know, Todd Bertuzzi in his prime, just kind of a big, strong power forward. But Canuck fans are really, really sour on him right now, especially since they've also had other power forwards coming from Buffalo in the last few years, Taylor Pyatt, Steve Bernier, who didn't pan out and were also touted as the next Todd Bertuzzi. So, I mean, he's got a ceiling that is beyond those two guys. If he can meet that ceiling, then Canuck fans are going to love him. They're absolutely going to love him. But until he starts to really show that, they don't like him.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can understand that, too, because Hodgson was very popular and more skilled. So that would appeal to fans. We're getting conflicting reports on Ryan Kesler's return date. I know you wrote an article on, I think it was you, wrote on maybe it was going to be opening night, some saying deep into the fall. We're hoping for March out here. what situation is it right now with regard to Kesler that you know?
Well, Kesler had surgery after the season ended, and his return date was slated for around December. And nothing has changed about that. That's still what his return date is supposed to be. The conflict came when Mike Gillis went on the Team 1040 radio here in Vancouver, and he said that Kesler could be back as early as October, maybe even by opening night if the season were to start on time. And, you know, this got people excited. It got some other people concerned because Kesler always seems to come back from injuries a little too soon. And then he has the question of whether or not he's fully healthy kind of hanging over him. So people were a little bit concerned about that. But his agent, Kurt Overhart, very quickly fired back and said that report is wrong. Kesler is not slated to return until December. My suspicion is, you know, a lot of people think that this maybe was some kind of rift between Overhart and Gillis. I think that Overhart is just making sure that Kesler still gets paid in the event of a lockout, as injured players are supposed to. I think all that was.
Yeah, that's a good point. Are the Giants a big deal out there? Like, if the Canucks are locked out, will the Giants' popularity pick up, or are they a hot commodity anyway?
They're a popular club, but the thing about Vancouver hockey fans is there's Canucks fans and then there's other hockey fans. You know, Vancouver hockey fans, if there's no Canucks hockey, oftentimes they just kind of go away for a while. You don't see a huge bump. You definitely didn't see a huge bump in, you know, hockey in the lower mainland here. After the Canucks were eliminated from the playoffs, people thought we might see more tickets sold for Abbotsford Heat hockey games, that sort of thing, and it didn't really happen. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many hockey fans trickle over to the Giants, but I think anybody predicting a big bump just because Canucks fans are looking for something else are probably mistaken.
Beautiful. Harrison, thanks for this, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That's Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy and Pass It to Bullis. You want to check it? Great blog, Pass It to Bullis. Even if you're not a Canuck fan, entertaining guy, great read, and obviously a guy who's got his finger on the pulse of the Vancouver Canucks, and we thank him for his time. Cam Charon from Leach Nation on the way. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:44. This is Nation Radio. We're on until 2 o'clock today. Then it's Jungle Jim Hunter. And Jeff Crichel joins us at 4 o'clock this afternoon with the Crush Health Show. And we're now joined by Cam Charon from Leafs Nation. How are you this afternoon, Cam?
Hi, Alan. It's good to be here as always.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. You're in Toronto?
Yeah, I'm still here. Very wet Toronto lately.
Is it really, eh?
Oh, yeah. It's awful. I have to stay inside and watch football all day.
Oh, you know, that sucks. Are you a CFL or NFL fan?
Anything. If there's athletic competition on TV, I'm probably watching it. I was up late last night watching Australian rules football, too.
Oh, my God. You're worse than I am. I'll watch anything but, like, opera and Australian rules football. But that's I like football. I like American college football, Canadian college football, CFL. NFL, I'm an old-timey guy. I'm not as big on that. Who do you follow on the CFL? Who's your team?
Oh, BC.
Oh.
You know, from Vancouver. It's really hard to get into the Argonauts here, too. There's just such little interest in the city. And I've kind of heard about that before coming in, but you wander around. It's a game day, and I live right downtown near the building, and you wouldn't know it. There was no activity until about 5 minutes before the game.
That's too bad, because you know what kills me as a like I grew up in the West, and in the West the CFL has always had strong pull, but the 100th Grey Cup is in Toronto, and I mean you got to excite the city about the 100th Grey Cup. We'd do bad things for that game, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I think it's, you know, the nod to the historical roots of the Toronto Argonaut Rugby Club and playing at York University or wherever. And so I guess they're keeping it around here because this is technically the birthplace of the game. But, yeah, you know, we'll see what happens. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people coming from out of town. Toronto's a big city that with lots to do. So,
yeah, that's true.
You know, any fans coming in from out of town, it'll be great for them.
And, you know, the Westerners always behave well when we go. So that'll be good, too. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit of hockey. What's up with this ridiculous ESPN survey that has the Leafs last among North American sports teams?
Yeah, I don't – their criteria – for that poll it seems extremely subjective. Things like fan or, you know, likability of players, you know, how nice the owner is. That's funny because there'll be owner, like, you know, there's one owner who runs maybe two or three teams, and those teams will be so wildly spread through the ownership rankings, standings. And it's funny when you look at kind of individual rankings for the teams. And Pittsburgh had something like the ninth most likable players in the NHL out of 30 teams. And I don't know anybody who likes Pittsburgh Penguin players in Canada or outside of Pittsburgh, pretty much. They have Matt Cook, and Sidney Crosby is, you know, perceived as extremely annoying in the media. And it's just sort of funny when you really break it down and look at just these sort of inaccuracies. And, you know, I think that the right way to rank it would be if it's such a bad fan experience, no one would buy it. And I think that what a good objective measure would be the amount of revenue contributed to the league, the amount of money that people are willing to spend on this team. And I think that the Leafs would rank pretty highly, and there's a lot of interest out here for Toronto, so it can't be that bad of a fan experience.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I'm in my 50s, and I've been aware of hockey since the 60s, and you can't pull two nice things out of me about Toronto, but the Maple Leafs are, you know, absolutely the most popular franchise in Canada. And you can go to a small town in Saskatchewan right now and find a Leafs jersey. I guarantee it. Name one. Somebody there cheers for the Leafs. So for me, it was outrageous beyond any other. I think Edmonton was 95th or something like that. And I guess maybe it's a matter of, as you mentioned, the criteria. But what a poor representation, I think, of Major League Sports in North America. And I think ESPN's better than that. That's my opinion.
Oh, yeah. And they were right behind Sacramento, and Sacramento, the prevailing wisdom is that they're more gone than the Coyotes are. And Phoenix was actually the best ranked fan experience among the NHL teams. And I think that if you're an individual Coyotes fan living in Glendale, then, you know, you're getting a pretty good team, pretty good value for your buck, but there's no guarantee that that team's going to stay there for, you know, even next season. I think it's still up in the air. They don't have the money yet.
Let's talk a little bit about the Leafs. I'm somewhat disappointed with the summer, only in that I like Brian Burke when he's belligerent and caterwauling, and he hasn't done a lot of that this summer. It's been kind of a quiet year in Toronto. Was that by plan, or did it just work out that way for the Leafs?
Something got into Brian Burke's coffee at some point, because he stopped being the belligerent, you know, reckless guy that we've known him to be in Vancouver. And you hear these stories about how on July 1st he was at the parade in Toronto, but he'd be checking his BlackBerry and he'd be seeing what guys were signing for, and he'd just say nope, 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 and he he thinks that players are so overpaid right now that he doesn't want to get in on that, it seems. And the funny thing is that the moves that he did make this summer, he got Jay McClement, he traded Luke Shen for James Van Riemsdyk. I think that the team got better, but he just didn't make enough moves. And it's clear that when he's a guy who does make these moves, the team does get better. He is very good at trades. He is very good at finding value in restricted free agent contracts. But when he does more than that, I think that part of what's holding the Leafs back is some of the unrestricted free agent deals that he signed in the past. When he's trying, you know, he tried to get Tim Connolly to be the first line center, and you know, Tim Connolly ended up costing him quite a bit of money, so he doesn't want to do that again. It's just, you know, there's too much risk, and every bad move is going to be parsed so bad, you know, so much over here that there's just no real point in doing it. I think that the new CBA structure will be interesting to see for the Leafs, but I don't think that Burke is the guy who's, you know, he's done small market teams almost his whole career, and he had a very tight, restrictive budget in all those places, and he has a lot more money and a lot more freedom in Toronto, and I just don't think he's used to it.
The deal that I thought he'd make, and I'll say the word Luongo, but it didn't have to be Luongo. He's got two young goaltenders. I like both of them. I think Scrivens is a really good young goaltender, and I like the Reimer kid too. But you might not want to go into a season with those two. Was there not a deal, and I guess the answer is no, because it didn't happen, where you package one of those goalies for, along with something else, for a Luongo or for somebody who is an established number one goaltender in the National Hockey League?
Well, the indication that we've been getting out of Vancouver is that Mike Gillis doesn't necessarily want to give Luongo up for, you know, just to get him off the books. And I think he's fine going into next season with 1A, 1B goalies in Luongo and Schneider. It's just a question of fitting them under the cap. And if you have to trade one, you got to trade Luongo. Now, the problem with moving him to Toronto is that Toronto doesn't necessarily have the pieces to acquire him, and without giving up someone who's, you know, a real significant piece in their rebuild, and that would be someone I think that the name on the Leafs depth chart, Clark MacArthur, is sort of the highest you can get without being untouchable. But he's, you know, he's not someone that you want to package with James Reimer or Ben Scrivens for Luongo if you're Vancouver. It's just, you know, these are players that can be picked up for cheap anywhere. And so I just don't think that Toronto has the assets to make a big deal for Luongo. I think that they need to build their prospect system. I think they need to keep signing guys out of the NCAA. And I think that they need to hold on to some draft picks and maybe actually unload one or two of their stars for younger players. And I look at Joffrey Lupo, and I don't think that Vancouver would want him, but, you know, somebody would for one or two prospects. And you can just slowly build up the prospect farm like that until, you know, you can package a couple of those guys together for a big major piece on your team.
Cam, are we seeing maybe that Brian Burke isn't going to get it done there? Is that what we're talking about here? And I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be let go tomorrow, but, you know, he's been there for a time, and he was brought in with a great reputation. And mm-hmm. and really, it's been same old, same old. Are we maybe seeing that Brian Burke is over halfway done his Toronto time?
Yeah. Well, I think he has one more year on his contract, and they're new owners at MLSE now, and you know that's going to be up to them. And this is quite a big year, and the Leafs are really going to need to show some sort of progress on the line, because you know that's really where Burke's job is going to come down to. And you know, there are going to be I think that there are people on the board who are going to be looking at all these properties now, and you know, the Raptors don't, you know, they're missing out on postseason revenue, and Toronto FC is missing out on postseason revenue, and the Toronto Maple Leafs are missing out on postseason revenue, and this is costing the organization quite a bit of money that, you know, they should be probably getting. And looking at the Leafs as the one team from lockout to lockout that didn't make the playoffs, and that's a huge deal for a lot of fans in Toronto. It's and you know, it all comes down to the new owners, with whether or not they think that Burke's going to be the guy going ahead. And so this year is going to be their evaluation period. I don't think that they're just going to come up and fire him tomorrow, as you said, but they're probably going to spend this year to evaluate him. And if they don't make the playoffs over the next season, there's got to be some real significant progress in at least one or two aspects of the organization.
Cam, thanks for this, man.
All right. Always good to be on, Alan.
All right. That's Cam Charron from Leafs Nation. Give us an interesting update. I've been thinking about Brian Burke in Toronto, you know, going there with such high expectation and, you know, having success in previous locales, specifically Anaheim. But something tweaked in my mind. I remember him giving credit to Brian Murray, and Murray did a lot of the building of that team. And I'm not suggesting that Brian Burke wasn't a part of the success there, but there was a really nice nest that had been put together by Brian Murray in Anaheim before they started really winning when Burke got there. And Toronto did not have that. And maybe that's part of the problem. And I think Cam addressed that a little bit about building up the prospect. They had a great draft, but, you know, it takes 2 or 3 years for that to get going. But our thanks to Cam Charron and our guest in the first hour. Coming up in hour number two, Eric Tulski is going to talk to us a little bit about, advanced stats and the Philadelphia Flyers. And we'll also have Thomas Drantz from Canucks Army, and next hour as well, Jonathan Willis from Cult of Hockey and Oilers Nation. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
We're into hour number two on a beautiful Saturday. Thanks so much for tuning into Nation Radio. We have the top Oilers stories of yesterday, today, and, well, tomorrow. And we've got some big news, of course, in regard to the National Hockey League with the negotiations going on. We'll talk about that and more. Oilers news is tough to find these days. Sam Gagner article, I think Jim Matheson had it in the Journal, talking about the fact that he was working with Sidney Crosby's trainer this summer over a few weeks and had really improved, and as far as speed and strength is concerned. And that's a big deal, because Gagner is already a pretty smart hockey player. All those assists that, you know, is proof of that. He's a great passer and can take a pass. And if he improves his speed, he's probably going to be with somebody like, say, Hemsky and maybe the rookie Nail Yakupov. And that could be an outstanding one or two line, but probably two line, with Nuge, Hall, and Eberle being the one line, depending upon how they break it down. And then a third line maybe of Jones, Horkoff, and Smith. And the fourth line, Belanger, maybe between rookies like, or young players like Hartikainen and Pajärvi. You also have, obviously, a lot of veterans around, like Ben Eager, Darcy Hordichuk as well. So a lot of options. Leonard Petrell's in there, too. A lot of options for the Edmonton Oilers. But Gagner, center has been a position that has been a problem for Edmonton for some time. But if he's improved in those two areas, that's really good news. Well, Kings preseason underway. They played in Prince George last night. Will again on Friday, coming in Red Deer. That's another preseason game for them. You might want to head down there and check it out. Oiler picks Mitchell Moraz and Travis Iwanek have already posted crooked numbers in the points column, and it's amazing to see just how many kids are returning from last year. This is going to be a big story no matter what happens with the NHL. The Oil Kings in the city of Edmonton, big story this year because they're a championship team. We'll have Corey Graham next weekend, and I think it's Kent Simpson the following weekend, and we'll try to get Cam Moon on here too as well. NHLPA, well, they've spoken to each other, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of progress. Pierre Lebrun reported earlier today the two sides spoke briefly but will not meet, may touch base tomorrow, whatever that means. And we talked to two of our guests in the last hour about the CBA negotiations, where they're headed. Terry Jones had mentioned that he thought that, you know, Grey Cup time would be maybe a point at which this sort of ends and they move on and they get the season started in early December. He said it might, you know, head to January, but likely not a sense and a feel that they're going to let the whole season fly. And Harrison Mooney said the same thing, that what it comes down to, the big money, the big thing is money. And, you know, losing an entire season for the owners and the players, that's almost impossible. And we hold on to that hope, and certainly hope that it does come to fruition. Connor, who was our winner, by the way?
You said Matthew was the winner.
Matthew, congratulations to Matthew, and you had another chance to win just around the corner. But right now, it's time for What you talking about? All right, Jonathan, let's start with your opinion of the lockout, where we are, where we might be, and what we're going to talk about if it happens.
Well, I think what we're going to talk about is what Taylor Hall and Jordan Eberle and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins are doing in whatever leagues they end up playing in. I think the Oklahoma City Barons, my guess is they'll end up with Nugent-Hopkins and perhaps Justin Schultz as well. And so we'll probably talk about them a lot. And then, of course, there's junior hockey and all the things happening in Europe. So we will have things to talk about, but if there's any kind of lockout, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw one of some length, given where the two sides are today.
One of the things that you looked at and I was impressed by was the push that some of these kids got by playing in the AHL during the last lockout. Spets, Parise as well. And some teams like the Philadelphia Phantoms really helped the Major League team the following year because they played together all year.
Yeah, I saw you referenced, I believe, the Phantoms on one of your blog posts, and that was an insanely good team, some excellent players there. And I think Eric Staal's the case I like to look at. In Carolina, he was a 34-point rookie, if I'm remembering right. He went down to the lockout, or went down during the lockout to the American League, was a point-per-game player, got to play first-line minutes and unlimited ice time in a very good league, and he came back. He was a 100-point guy the next year and helped the team win the Stanley Cup. So I think from a perspective of development, a lockout isn't going to be a bad thing for the Edmonton Oilers. Taylor Hall, Jordan Eberle, they will play. They will play in a good league. They'll get a lot of ice time. And guys like Nugent Hopkins, Justin Schultz, this is good. I mean, nobody wants to see the NHL go away for a year, but the Edmonton Oilers are one of the few teams that's really going to benefit from all the development those young players get if there is any kind of lengthy stoppage.
What's your take on what the owners want? I keep running this around in my head. It seems to me like it's a triangle, Jonathan. There's the rich owners, the owners losing money, and then the players. And the owners overall, both rich and poor, seem to want the players to pay for everything to make up the difference. It doesn't seem on the face of it to be fair. That's a really quick thumbnail sketch. But is that about right?
To a degree. The one thing I would argue is the poor owners, because the small market teams have really not been an issue for Gary Bettman and the league as a whole. Gary Bettman said that revenue sharing, it's a distraction. It's not really a main priority. The sides aren't that far apart on it. We saw the league's initial proposal actually suggested raising the salary cap floor as a percentage of the overall cap. So what they're doing is they're actually making it more difficult for small market teams. By raising the salary cap floor, they're making it so that those teams need to pay a higher percentage of money as the rich teams do. Right now, it's $8 million below. They want to see it raised by $4 million relative to the salary midpoint. And when he poo-poos revenue sharing, it suggests to me that the poor owners really aren't the priority for the league right now. The priority for the league right now is to get as much money as they can. The NFL and the NBA, the players there both pull in about 50% of league revenue. And the NHL feels that's where they want to go. And they know from the last lockout that the union, even under solid leadership, which they do have now, and even unified, which they haven't been in some time, will crumple. They will not stand firm. They know that. They also know from the last lockout that fans will welcome them back with open arms. They know they'll come back to the arenas when the lockout ends. And I think those two lessons have convinced them that they can get the percentage down to 50% where they want it. That 7% a year at current revenue is more than $200 million between the owners. So they're looking at this as a way to add a lot of money to their pockets. And it's not really about what's fair or what's right. And I don't really have a perspective here on what is fair or right, because how do you decide what percentage the players should be getting? I think that's a matter of personal perspective. What matters here is leverage. The owners have lots of it. The players don't have any. They don't think the league's going to be harmed by a labor stoppage, so they're going to use that leverage and get as much money as they can.
I've always felt, and I do some negotiating in my actual life, and if you're indifferent to the outcome, and it appears as though the NHL owners are, if they're not indifferent, they're doing a hell of a job of pretending they are, that does give them the kind of advantage that is very difficult to overcome in a negotiation.
It is, and especially Donald Fehr and the union are in a difficult position because Fehr has been on the job the longest, a few months will be the longest serving executive since executive directors spy on players. They've had all sorts of problems. And because it's coming from behind, I've been searching the last few days what the union can do. Because to me, that's an interesting story. Is And what they've done is they've rewritten the NHLPA Constitution. It's available on their website. And they've instituted much stricter penalties than were available during the last lockout for players who speculated publicly or said things that were damaging to the union's interests. So I'm curious this time around if they can maybe present more of a unified front than the owners did, than the owners can. I think it's still a long shot because there's 700-odd players and only 30 owners, and the league has been famous for the amount of discipline they had last lockout. I think they'll be disciplined again, and I don't think the players can overcome the position the league is in.
All right, let's move on from the lockout. I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things you wrote this week. Beginning with your Jordan Eberle comparables look, I really liked your conclusion, which was basically a range between Milan Mihalik, who's a solid NHL player and fringe first liner, and Patrick Elias, who I would suggest is a borderline Hall of Famer. I would say not a cynical look, but a fair look at Eberle's window in terms of his abilities. What was the reaction you got from that article?
It was sort of a mixed reaction. Some of the people who are really really pessimistic about Eberle's upside didn't like the way I did certain things. They questioned, for instance, his on-ice shooting percentage was quite high this year, and they questioned whether his assist totals were really representative of his overall talent going forward. And then the people who were really bullish on Eberle felt that I wasn't giving him proper respect for being a well-above-average NHL shooter. I wasn't giving proper respect to Nugent Hopkins as a well-above-average NHL passer. So when you take criticism from both sides like that, I sometimes take it as a bit of a good sign. For me personally, I think it's very difficult to know how a player 2 years into his NHL career is going to play for the next decade. And the Oilers have signed him for a long-term deal. They're gambling. We're all projecting at this point, and none of us really knows the answer. So what I tried to do in that piece was I tried to be fair, because, I mean, I'm a fan, you're a fan, you do a reasonable expectations series, and you know how difficult it is to make a projection that allows for your fan bias. So we all tend to project best-case scenario because we deal with these guys all the time, and it's easy to imagine what happens in a blue-sky world. It's easy to picture Jordan Eberle being a 90-point player for the rest of his career. I don't think that those blue-sky projections are really rational, so what I tried to do was look at historical comparables in a fair way that allows for some of the exceptional things that happened, but also allows for the fact that Jordan Eberle is a very good NHL player. He scored 70 points at a very young age. These are significant achievements, and they represent something that means he's probably going to have a very good career down the line.
Well, and the other thing is, and this is the point that I always try to make, is if he has another enormous season, then we have to give him full credit for that. The guy has improved his shooting percentage. If he can sustain it or hit 17, then we have to say this was beyond expectations, correct?
I think so. With respect to shooting percentage, I don't... It's going to take at least 2 years of high-end shooting percentages for me to be convinced that he's a really elite shooter, because that 18.9% mark he put up last year, that's better than anybody. The best since the lockout is Alex Tanguay, who shoots much less frequently than Eberle does, and he was an 18% shooter. So I can't imagine him sustaining it. I'll need to see several years of data before I believe he's really a 19 or even a 17% shooter. But I don't have any difficulty believing he's a 14 or 15% shooter if he has another year in that range.
You also wrote this week about, I've got a buddy, he's a neighbor of mine, and every time I start waxing poetic about the Oilers' summer, he says two words, and they are Leonard Petrell. And the problem for me with Leonard Petrell is he's the guy that I was hoping that they would sign for the what I call the Prisani 2.0 role. But he's not, based on the one season, Jonathan, really ideal for that situation, correct?
Yeah, I don't... The fourth line last year got killed, and it's hard to differentiate which player was responsible for it on an individual level. We know that Ben Eager's not a great NHLer, but he's a decent fourth line guy. He's had some good years in Chicago. It's probably not him. I don't think Anton Lander was ready for the role he was put in last year, but I don't think it was all him either. Petrell was very good in a reserve role on the penalty kill, but he got hammered at even strength. And even with his good points, I mean, he's big, he's physical, he's I don't question his courage or his commitment level or his willingness to do whatever the coach tells him. But I just, to me, I don't think he's as good a player now as Teemu Hartikainen or Magnus Pajärvi. And the team in the past has been reluctant to allow a superior player on a two-way contract supplant an inferior player on a one-way deal. We've seen Matthew Waugh beat out Tom Gilbert in training camp because of waiver concerns. We saw Jeff Petrie in the minors last year while Cam Barker and Theo Pekham and Corey Potter played in the NHL. Now, there's a case for any one of those individuals, but there's no doubt that Tom Gilbert was a better player than Matthew Waugh. There's no doubt that Jeff Petrie is a better player than any of the three I just named. So my fear is that they'll ice an inferior team next year because Leonard Petrell is on a one-way deal and Magnus Pajärvi can be sent to the minors. So I guess what I'm getting at is if they look at Petrell and say, well, we didn't sign him to a lot of money, we've got him here for depth and we'll send him to the minors if he's beat out in camp, then great. But I don't think that's how they're looking at it, and I don't think Magnus Pajärvi or Teemu Hartikainen deserve to be in the minors if Petrell's on the NHL roster.
In conversation with Jonathan Willis from the Cult of Hockey, one more Oiler question and we'll move on to what you have planned. Steve Tambellini stated this week in conversation with Mark Spector, the club has continued looking for a veteran defenseman even after the signing of Justin Schultz and is doing it now, although it is difficult. If the Oilers were to sign or trade for, which is more likely, a veteran defenseman, Jonathan, how outrageous would it be if that happens to suggest the Oilers would be in a position to shoot for the playoffs come the trade deadline?
I think it depends on your goaltending. If Devan Dubnyk holds up, then with another veteran defenseman, I think they could. I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that the playoffs are a possibility. Everybody knows the Oilers finished 14th in the West last year, but they only had a minus 27 goal differential. I don't think this team is as bad as their position in the standings would indicate. The other thing, though, is I very much doubt they'll add another defenseman. I listened to the same interview with Steve Tambellini, and as somebody who follows the Oilers, you kind of get used to this story. You know, you get used to the idea, oh, they tried to trade up on draft day to grab Yanni Pitkinen or whatever story it is. They're always trying. They don't often succeed. And Steve Tambellini, to me, seemed pessimistic about the idea of being able to land a defenseman. It sounded to me like the cost was too high and they weren't expecting it to drop, particularly with teams like Detroit still looking. So if everything holds up, if everything, best case scenario, everything goes well next year, I think they could be a playoff club. But realistically, I don't think they're going to add a defenseman, and I think the playoffs are going to have to wait another year.
Assuming the NHL does start, when we talk about prospects outside the NHL and maybe outside the AHL as well, the Oilers have some interesting guys, Martin Gernat, Tobias Reeder, there's the Zharkov kid and a few others. Which of those players, in your opinion, has the best chance to not necessarily break out, but make a step forward this winter and really wow the Oilers fans, perhaps the way Reeder did this past year?
I think Reeder is probably the most likely candidate, it seems a little strange to say that. Daniel Zharkov is another one who comes to mind, but I'm not really a believer in him as a player. I'm a little on the pessimistic side on him. Reeder could be the first Oilers prospect since Jordan Eberle to score 50 goals in junior, and I think if he does that, last year he had one good year, we're kind of looking at him as a guy who might be a top six option. If he scores 50 goals this year, I think we really have to say, look, the Oilers have another guy who is really going to push for a top six role in the NHL on merit. And Reeder, you got to love the guy. I mean, size isn't ideal, but he's one of the best penalty killers in the OHL, according to OHL coaches. There's a lot to like about that player. I think he's the guy.
On the Cult of Hockey, not long ago, David Staples did a rating of those who were best at projecting year-over-year Oiler results. I wanted to spend a little time on that, Jonathan.
I knew you would. I knew you would.
I beat you.
Yes, you did, and it wasn't even close. You hammered me. And much to my chagrin, I discovered that I was far too optimistic last year in rating Oilers players. yeah, so that's something to keep in mind. I'm one of those people who likes to think he keeps his bias well in check, who acknowledges it and compensates for it, but I clearly didn't do a very good job of that last year, and it's something I'm going to have to look at going forward.
It's tough, though, and I'm teasing because I enjoy those rankings, but the difficulty, I think, is in really realistically looking at the time on ice, who's going to get the power play time. For me this year, the difficulty was getting all those wingers enough power play time to have any kind of impact.
Yeah, that is the question, because they do have a ton of talent, and you wonder where they're all going to play. Between Smith and Yakupov and Hemsky and Eberle and all the rest, I mean, there's only two power play units, and really, realistically, the first unit's going to get the lion's share of the time. And the other issue, too, is the power play had an outrageous shooting percentage last year that may or may not be repeatable. But that's the question, is just where do all these guys go? And there's so much uncertainty. In one of those pieces, David Staples also talked to Tom Awad, who, if I'm not mistaken, beat both of us in his projections. And he said, you know, there's just so much uncertainty, you're never going to find a bang-up system that tells you what's going to happen. We don't know the future. We're never going to know the future.
All right, you write for so many sites, but I'm going to limit you to two. What have you got coming up on Cult of Hockey and Oilers Nation?
With regard to Cult of Hockey, I'm researching right now. I'm going to have a slow weekend because I'm heading out of town, but I'm researching Donald Fehr and the NHLPA, because Donald Fehr jumped ship into an impossible situation, and I'm wondering what on earth would possess him to do that, and trying to get inside his little head a little bit and see what he's thinking, what he could possibly be hoping to accomplish. And on Oilers Nation, there's a few pieces I want to run. I want to look at that power play. I want to look at how it worked last year, how it might work in the future, and just try and project a little more for the upcoming season, what might be reasonable to expect to certain players, and who might be in line not to repeat what they did last year.
Jonathan, thanks for this. Have a great weekend.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Alan.
Jonathan Willis from Cult of Hockey and Oilers Nation and other parts, Grantland as well. And basically giving us a little bit of information on the Edmonton Oilers. Did a great Eberle comparables on Oilers Nation. You want to check that out. Really good article. Talking about his upside and what he might emerge as being, and Patrick Ilyesh at the utter marker. That's a fine hockey player. And I think that Edmonton Oilers fans should be, over the moon about Jordan Eberle and where he was drafted. And I think my own feeling is the draft is the key to all of this. The Edmonton Oilers 12 years ago didn't have any money, but the real problem was that they hadn't drafted well. Because if you don't have any money and you draft well, you're Nashville. And that's not bad. The Oilers now have an owner with money. They have a possibly an arena coming. We still kind of up in the air about that. And they've got this fabulous talent that Stu McGregor and his group have brought along. So, I mean, everything's coming up roses. The lockout is this giant cloud. It's like watching Independence Day. It's over, you know, Washington right now. But when the clouds clear, Edmonton Oilers fans are going to have a nice run here. And it's a good day in Edmonton when the lockout is over, because this team, I think this year is about a 9-11 team in the Western Conference. But if things break right and Taylor Hall goes supernova and this Yakupov kid is as good as advertised, and they do something about the defense and Dubnyk can play, and I know that's a lot of ifs, but it's been more ifs in the past, and I think this team is going to do something special, if not this year, then in the future years. 124, Eric Tulski on the way next. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
129, we're around until 2 o'clock today, and joined now by Eric Tulski. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Eric's at, by the way, at Broad Street Hockey and NHL Numbers as well. Your Flyers preview is up at NHL Numbers, and I have some math questions for you about it. But the first one isn't a math question. How much did are you backing up?
Something like that. Here's the question.
How much did Ilya Bryzgalov's unique personality, what appeared to be a crisis of confidence and then difficulty with the media, in your opinion, impact the Flyers' season?
Yeah, I don't know. This is the kind of thing, you know, I have no idea. And I don't think anyone else does either, really. it's really easy to say he's suffering from distractions, you know, that's why he's doing badly. But nobody ever connects that to something specific on the ice. Nobody says, hey, you could tell on that shot he was thinking about HBO when he should have been fighting through the screen. Or, you know, it's, hey, you know he must have been thinking about HBO during some video session because he should have known that shooter was going backhand. It's just, we can't tell. We don't know what's going on in his head. He had some bad games. He had a lot of bad games, and maybe it's related to the distractions. I don't know. People like to say that stats guys discount the emotional aspects because you can't quantify them, but it's really not that. It's that I don't even know what emotions he has, much less whether it's even affecting him. I can't tell from 200 feet away.
Then let me ask you another question that we sort of know. Phoenix is a more of a button-down team based on their coach, and Philadelphia had some issues defensively this year, Pronger's injury being one of them. That might have had a great deal of impact, maybe more than the stats or the non-stats guys would believe based on previous performance by Brizgalov.
Yep, no doubt. And it's interesting, so both he and Bobrovsky had actually pretty decent save percentages at even strength, and both of them had terrible save percentages on the penalty kill. And, you know, it's team effects are a subject of controversy on save percentage. Some people believe in it, some people don't. Some people think it's somewhere in between, you know, maybe significant, maybe not. But when you have two different goalies both doing really terribly on the penalty kill, and penalty kill is a place where if there's going to be a system effect, that's where you might expect to see it. So it's entirely possible that the team had some struggles and put him in some bad spots.
As an Oilers fan, I'm fascinated by Philadelphia's huge trades and signings. They're always making the big play, and they've always kind of been that way. From our end, Oilers are kind of a button-down group as far as deals are made, certainly in the last two or three years. Philadelphia has definitely gone the other way over the last long period of time. Do Flyer fans enjoy the thrill ride? Is that something that the Flyers as an organization do to appeal to their fans?
I don't think they do it for the fans. I think they do it for their number one fan, Ed Snyder, who I think is very antsy to get back to championship hockey in his old age. You know, it certainly keeps the off season lively. It makes for some fun times on the blog. In general, for me, I've liked an awful lot of the players who they've let go, so it hasn't necessarily been fun for me. Their approach is different from the one I'd take. They really focus on just adding good players whenever they can, however they can, and figuring out how to make the roster work later. That's not my style, but they've been pretty successful with it. So, you know, it's worked for them. It hurts me when I have to see players like Gagne, who was a star, or even lesser players who I kind of liked, like Betts and Nodal, just had to be let go for nothing because there wasn't room on the roster for them anymore. And that, you know, that's tough emotionally sometimes, but there's no doubt they've been successful.
What should let me ask you this question first. How does a team go about replacing Chris Pronger?
Yeah, well, so there is no replacement for Chris Pronger. I mean, I think he's one of the true greats, and nobody could easily just replace him. And the Flyers in particular really don't have a pipeline on defense the way they do on offense. And so they were a team that was built around having Pronger and Timonen be the stars in their old age, and then they had a second-tier crew coming into their prime in Carl and Coburn and Mazaros. And none of those guys is going to step in and be Pronger. And they tried to get Shea Weber. They kind of tried to get Ryan Suter, and that didn't work. So there's going to be a hole there. With that being said, the team and Pronger are both still holding out some hope that he'll be back. He is around the rink these days. I know he's still experiencing headaches, so it seems like a long shot, but it's not for certain yet that they'll have to replace him. But if he's out, there's no doubt it's going to hurt them.
What should Flyers fans, there's a lot of Flyer fans in Alberta and in Edmonton. They're a very popular team. So what should the fans of the Philadelphia Flyers expect in 12-13? Is it going to be a down year, or is there enough talent there for them to bridge the gap?
Yeah, both, I think. I think there's plenty of talent, and I would be very surprised to see them miss the playoffs and pretty surprised to see them not be one of the better teams in the conference. I do think it's a step back, though. The offense, I think at best, will be similar. And, you know, losing Jágr and Van Riemsdyk and having some regression from players who had career years last year, it's hard to see them making up for that. They do have some young guys coming along who will make up for some of it. But I have to think the offense is not going to be that, you know, top two or three in the league that it was the last couple of years. And on defense, there's no question they're worse, I think. After the trade deadline last year, the defense was pretty questionable, and that might be being kind. And this year, it's that same lineup, except replacing Carl with Luke Shen, which I see as a clear step backwards. Carl was their ice time leader last year, and Luke Shen was on the third pairing for a team that had a bad defense. So I think that, you know, Shen has potential, but I think that has to be a step back for the coming year. And so, if the offense is maybe going to be as good or maybe a little bit worse and the defense is taking a clear step back, I think the team is pretty clearly not as good as last year. But they do still have a lot of talent, and they'll be in the mix regardless.
Eric, on NHL numbers on the 16th of August, you wrote an article, competition metric based on ice time, and I read it about four or five times, and I have a couple of questions. What is the idea? What is it designed to measure?
Sure. So the idea is you want to measure how good the opponents that a player faces are, and we have a few different ways of doing that, and the most common ways look at the results of the guys who you play against. How good was their plus minus or their shot differential or whatever you might use to decide on what someone's results are. What I did here was instead of looking at their results, I looked at their usage. I said, you know, the guys who get the most ice time are generally the best players on the team. And so if you are continually on the ice against the people who lead the other team in ice time, you're probably facing their best players. And so that let us really pull out the quality of competition in a way that's independent of results. And that's important because results can be affected by usage. Mm-hmm. So if I ask what kind of competition did Henrik Sedin face, well, he faced players who faced a lot of players like Sedin. And so they may not have had great results just because of how they were used. And so looking at whether they were the guys who got the top minutes on their team might tell me more about how good they were than how they did in their minutes against a guy like Sedin.
Someone like Sedin, did he often play against great forwards and great defensemen, or was it a matter of sometimes mix and match?
Yeah, so that was the other thing that I did with this, was I separated out the ice time of the opposing forwards and defensemen, and it turned out that a lot of cases you have players like Sedin who are used in a scoring role, they faced the weaker forwards on the other team. And so in the traditional competition metrics, that made it look like they faced weak opposition. But in fact, the top line on almost every team faced the opponent's top defenseman regardless. So it gives you a picture of who's used as a two-way forward facing the top forwards and defensemen, or who is used as a scoring forward facing the top defensemen but lesser forwards, and who's used as in a kind of shutdown role facing the top forwards but weaker defensemen. And it gives you a little bit finer picture of how a guy was used than just did he face good players. It's more about what kind of players he faced.
Excellent. Eric, thanks for this. Appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
All right, that's Eric Tulski from Broad Street Hockey and NHL Numbers. Honestly, read a competition metric based on ice time, August 16th on NHL Numbers if you have a chance. Fascinating stuff. The group think tank, and I'll include Eric in that, and there's a bunch of others, and we've had many of them on this show. They're really moving the conversation forward. I'm not close to caught up or even understanding all of it, but get on that train, because it really helps you enjoy the game when you can look at the stats and see what happened afterwards and who's zooming who, as Vic Ferrari said a million years ago. It's 1:40. We'll take a break. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
You know, a week from today will be September 15th. We've been talking about September 15th in hockey terms for, a year now or so? And it looks like it's going to be, you know, down to the wire, would put it mildly. But as far as the NHL and Players Association talking today are concerned, the latest information that we have available, Pierre LeBrun tweeted out this morning saying there was no meeting today. There was a chat. I think it was the younger Fuhrer and maybe Bill Daly had talked, and there was a possibility of meeting tomorrow. And that's good news, because there was a period of time during the week where they weren't speaking at all. And there's really nothing to update, though. This is a game of chicken, basically, and it could impact in a lot of ways. But for Edmonton Oilers fans, this is a time where, you know, you just have to wait and see. There are some good things happening, though. The Oil Kings played in Prince George last night. They play again Friday night against Red Deer in Red Deer. I want to head down and hit that game. We'll have hopefully Cam Moon on next week, and Corey Graham and Ken Simpson the following week as we gear up for the beginning of the Oil Kings season. Oklahoma City Barons, their season is, it's about a month away. I think it's October 16th that it starts, maybe the 12th. And their training camp usually dovetails with the NHL camp, so they would start maybe September 25th or 27th, somewhere in there. But as of right now, as far as we know, the Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is a player Edmonton may send down there. Doubtful that Hall and Eberle would go, but man, that would be an outstanding team, much like the Philadelphia Phantoms. I wrote about this earlier in the week. The last lockout, players like Jason Spezza and Zach Parise went down, and they had really strong seasons, and they used that to really springboard themselves into impact players in the National Hockey League. You recall Alex Hemsky played, I think, on a line with Jagr. He played left wing during the lockout, and he came back, and he had just stepped up smartly. I think he got 77 points in the 05-06 season. So even if the unthinkable happens and the Edmonton Oilers end up losing an entire season, these kids will be developing in other areas. For somebody like Hall and Eberle, the possibility of going to Europe is there. Maddie wrote this week about maybe the entire group going down to Oklahoma City. That would have a major impact. You might see some really good hockey players in Stockton of the East Coast League or the ECHL, because if you send Hall and Eberle and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Pajärvi and Hartikainen down, then guys like Curtis Hamilton and Tyler Pitlick and that group may not be available to play or not get enough minutes. So interesting times for the Edmonton Oilers, and certainly if you're a fan of the Oilers and hockey, this might be a time where you're going, hey, what's going on? There's not a lot shaking. What are we going to do? Well, on the Oilers Nation site today, I posted links to, I'm going to say, conservatively 20 different blog sites that you might want to check out. These are sites you can go to, like Guy Flaming, who does the Pipeline Show between 10 and noon. He's got a blog called Coming Down the Pipe. Great blog. He not only covers junior hockey, but also NCAA hockey, USHL, the WHL from above, taking note with Greg Drinnen, Sean Mullen, Swift Current Broncos blog. There's a lot of really good WHL blogs and things that are definitely of interest. So there's something that you can check out there. Small Thoughts at Large, another WHL one. The Scouting Report is a fun one because it gives you an idea right now, and lots of people aren't into this, but right now it gives you an idea about who's ranked where in the National Hockey League for the top 30, the first round next year. And this is a year out, so you got to give them credit for actually doing it. But they have Nathan MacKinnon ranked number one from Halifax of the Q. This is a kid who has had all kinds of good things said about him. He's been touted as a potential number one pick for a long time now. They're saying since he was about 15 years old. Seth Jones from Portland, we talked about him late. During the last draft, people were saying, look, if this guy were available, he could go number one during the 2012 draft. So that's something you want to check out too. But the Oilers Nation blog post is called I Will Follow. you want to check it out. Lots of different links there that you might want to be staying tuned to if there is a lockout for junior hockey, for prospects, and for Oiler kids who you might not know a lot about and want to learn more about. 150 joined now by Thomas Drance. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm very well. I was reading about Shane Doan today, and we talked about it on the show earlier, about, you know, he wants to go to Phoenix. And then you had a conversation with Sharon, or maybe back and forth. Do you feel like Doan is a perfect fit in Vancouver, or do you think at the money that's been rumored, he might be an overpay for them?
You know, I think you're not getting Doan without overpaying for him. That's the nature of unrestricted free agency in a player who has, you know, as we know from the Buffalo offer, a ton of options. You just don't even get in the door with Shane Doan, I think, unless you're offering him 4 years, $5 million, and of course it's a 35-plus contract. I mean, you're not going to sign Shane Doan and get an efficient deal. That said, you know, we've seen with the Canucks and who they've targeted at the draft. I mean, they've drafted six players who are above 6'2" and weigh more than 200 pounds in the last 2 years, since their loss in the Stanley Cup final to a very large team in Boston. They also went out and traded for David Booth, and they also traded Cody Hodgson for Zach Cassian. So, you know, this is a team that's bled a lot of treasure in search for that sort of power forward type. And, you know, we've seen also from this management team with the Matt Sundin contract. I mean, this is a team that our management team that places a lot of importance on the idea of mentorship and on veteran leadership. So, you know, I suspect that the Canucks certainly think that Shane Doan is the right piece. You know, whether or not they're right, that's debatable. And, you know, perhaps we'll see, though it's clear that Shane Doan's preference is to go back to Phoenix.
Where are we with Luongo? I say that because, you know, he basically said Florida's a good fit for me, which was, everybody's talking about the NHLPA and NHL negotiations, so it kind of, maybe people weren't aware of it, but I thought that was a very unusual thing for a player to say, hey, I'd be a good fit here.
Yeah, it was unusual, but it wasn't surprising. I mean, the idea that Luongo's been steering trade talks toward the Panthers, you know, that's been the worst-kept secret in Vancouver all summer. It's been clear that he'd like to go back there. His wife is from there. Both of his kids were born there, and he lives there in the off season. That said, the way that it was reported, right, Luongo practicing at Florida Panthers practice facility. Well, you know, he does that every year.
Yeah.
It was a little odd. I mean, this wasn't new news. It was just sort of another comment that Luongo made that maybe the media ran with, as we've seen happen to him so many times during his career. You know, that said, I think there's an element to which Florida is his preference. There's no doubt about that. And I think that the idea that Luongo wouldn't approve a trade elsewhere has impacted the market. We'll see what happens, though. This is going to be a very interesting week for the Canucks. They're still in negotiations with the likes of Edler and Burrows for extensions. Those might come in under the wire before the CBA expires a week from today. And then also, Luongo's coming back to Vancouver. He's going to be participating in a charity golf tournament on Wednesday. So he'll be back in Vancouver, and we'll field questions from the media, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of fuel. You know, we'll have some fuel poured on the fire that is Luongo trade speculation.
Do you think the Canucks, a team that is a strong Stanley Cup contender, I don't think anybody can deny that, have more at stake this lockout than perhaps any other team? Just by the nature of how they lost in 10, it was in Game 7. That was a series that at times they looked to be well ahead of Boston in terms of skill, but they didn't get it done. The window is never very large. Would this possibly hurt Vancouver more than other Cup contenders?
Well, you know, I think losing, first of all, the Canucks traditionally start extremely slow, right? They're slow starters. So losing October probably works to their advantage. I also think that losing part of the season benefits the Canucks because I think, you know, this is a team with guys like the Sedins who place a lot of emphasis on physical fitness. And I think they're, you know, if you look at their third period splits, right, they're one of the best third period teams in the league over the last three seasons. That's not a coincidence. This is just a fitness-obsessed Canucks team. And any guys like Shane O'Brien or Kyle Wellwood, who are both good players but maybe aren't you know, quite as dedicated. Those guys never seem to last long in Vancouver. So, you know, I think losing part of the season could work in their favor, even though, you know, it doesn't give them the full 82 games to let their quality show through. That said, I think losing the full season would be an unmitigated disaster. I mean, the Sedins are on the wrong side of 30, so is Burrows. Kessler's, you know, not getting any younger. He's 27 now, but he's always hurt. And then, I think having a Luongo situation sort of drag on, like, I think it would be an ideal situation. I mean, if the Canucks can't move Luongo in the next, before hockey comes back, whenever that is, that situation will begin to really fester and could be weird and very awkward, especially if sort of a lockout knocked out the entire season. So, you know, I think they'd lose a lot from a full season lockout. I think that would be an unmitigated disaster. A partial lockout, I think they actually might fare better than some of the other teams.
Thomas, thanks for this, man. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Alan. All the best.
All right. Thomas Drantz, Eric Tulsky, Cam Charron, Harrison Mooney, Terry Jones, Jonathan Willis, and, of course, Connor Halley. Thanks so much. We'll be back next Saturday at noon. Have a great weekend.